Opinions expressed therein are those of the individual speakers and callers and do not necessarily represent the views of KFAR Radio or any of our respective employees, affiliates, or sponsors of this program.
Good morning, Fairbanks. You are listening to KFAR Radio. We are at 660 on the AM dial, 97.5 on the FM dial, and we live stream at KFARradio.com. This is Problem Corner. I'm your host, David Pruse. If you have a call for my guest today, it's 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. And today's date is a Wednesday, second Wednesday of the month, which means
Nick Nugent is on with an Alaska history subject.
Exactly. How'd you like that intro, Fairbanks? The stuff that you bring now, we're coming into golden days.
We are.
And Fairbanks is built on mining. Still big here. Still big here. And I like your category today, or your choice, rather. A miner. Not a big one. Probably one that no one has ever heard of.
May have a few people know him here in Fairbanks because of the family and the fact they lived here, but we are going to talk about Elmer Katturi. Elmer, I think, sort of typifies a lot of the miners. He started in the late 20s, mined till after the Second World War, had some successes, had some failures. It's a good story. He did well enough. He put all of his children through the University of Washington. And probably something most people who live here in Fairbanks will remember, his son, Ray, was the owner and founder of Ray's Electric. So Fairbanks connection there, certainly.
Miners back then, like he, was an expert in anything mechanical.
Certainly was.
I mean, just reading about what you sent me, and he started at a young age doing it, and he said, he caught onto it real fast, like automobiles, but his brothers, forget it.
Well, I thought it was interesting. He said he didn't particularly like the animal part of farming, so he was very happy to do the mechanical part.
And he started out on a farm in where?
New York State. Actually, a small one in Michigan, but they moved to New York State when he was very young.
He was Finnish?
Yes.
And when he was young, he was talking about, trapping skunks.
Yeah. We can get to that story here in a minute. It is pretty good. One of the things to look at when we talk about Elmer is his story's one of that of a lot of other miners. Mm-hmm. And they came to Alaska for economic opportunity. They're not household names, but they are miners with successes. They worked on because it's how they grew up. And I think that really stands out in a lot of these stories. A lot of these miners were people who lived when there was no social safety net, and they knew work, and they kept working. So Elmer starts the story, and I enjoy the way he starts his... A lot of what we're taking comes out of his self-published autobiography, Trails and Tailings. If anybody is interested in that book, if you Google Trails and Tailings and Elmer Katturi, K-E-T-U-R-I, that will be one of the first choices. It leads to a website where the publication is online. Also, there are some videos there of recovering a Caterpillar tractor out of the Yukon River that are just fascinating to see.
You'll get into that one, too.
We will. We'll come up with that.
Yeah, my goodness.
Well, Elmer says that, interestingly, in the early days in Finland, something I didn't know, a farm usually had a name.
Yeah, I read that.
Yeah, and they actually changed their family name to match the farm. It had been Satala before they bought the Katturi farm.
There's no Pruse family farm in Alaska ever.
That's too bad, Dave. Yeah. It'd be a paradise, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. A lot of barbecue equipment out at that farm.
So it said his father came from Finland in 1891 when he was 18 years old, settled in Houghton, Michigan, because he knew some people there. The first thing they taught him was to say, "I want work," you know, with the accent. And he said he went from place to place repeating these three words, finally got a job in an underground iron mine. His mother, Amanda Perala, came from Finland in 1900. She was only 15 at the time, and ended up in Houghton, where they had friends also. Well, the New York farm, 1921, was called the West Plantation near Halsey Valley. It had been owned by the West family, so mm-hmm. it had nothing to do with direction, for years and years. And Elmer tells us, he says, "I trap skunks in the fall and winter to make a little money. Pelts with the least white bought the best price." In winter of 1919, his Uncle Gus and Aunt Ina came to visit from Alaska, and Gus lent me a brand new rack. He says, "Rent me a brand new raccoon coat to wear to school one morning during a fierce snowstorm." He said, "I checked some of my traps and had a skunk." So he carefully lays the coat off to the side, killed the skunk, walked to school proudly wearing the coat. And as he walked in the door, the teacher yelled, "Elmer Katuri, you get out of here, and don't you ever come in here smelling as you do." He said, "I began to worry that the skunk did spray some on the coat." He walked into their kitchen when he got home after school, and Gus, he says, blew his top. Uncle Gus did. He said, "I should have known better than to let a skunk master wear my coat." But a neighbor told him, here's another thing I had never heard. A neighbor told him to dig a hole into thawed ground, bury the coat for 2 days, then hang it out to air, and that worked. Why or how, I have
just,
no
idea. Yeah, just natural extraction.
So anything, if you get something sprayed by a skunk, if you can bury it, might as well try it.
Then air it out, yeah.
Well, he says he never liked farming. He did like tinkering and repairing machinery. And when he was 12, his father bought a 1913 Model T Ford pickup. He spent a lot of time tinkering with it and was actually the first to learn to drive it.
So he was born about 1901.
Yes. And when he was 17, he wanted to go to Detroit to an auto mechanic school, but his mother couldn't possibly think of letting him go off to a big city by himself at that age. So he stayed. By the time he was 21, he talks about a number of the cars they had owned other than the Model T, a Mitchell 6.
I got to look up the REO Speedwagon, named after my favorite band. I got to look that up.
R.E. Oldsmobile.
R.E. Oldsmobile.
Yeah, that was
R.E. Oldsmobile.
Yeah, that was the Oldsmobile fame. Yeah. He was the founder of that company, and they just shortened it to R.E.O.
Yeah, and then they had a Speedwagon.
Yes.
Named after one of my favorite bands.
Something totally not to do with Alaska history, but when I was growing up, we'd go to visit friends in Champaign, Illinois, and R.E.O. Speedwagon at that time was a fraternity and garage band that played all the local dances.
They got bigger.
The days before fame.
Yeah,
certainly.
They got bigger.
Well, he talks about they just kept, you know, trying to earn a little bit of money and get better vehicles so they could do more carrying. He hauled milk in 40-quart cans with the speed wagon to a creamery. And from there, it was shipped in railroad tank cars to New York City. And that was actually a big process at the time. There would be, like we see trains that are all coal hoppers.
Yeah.
They would have trains coming from the countryside into New York City that were nothing other than insulated tank cars to carry the milk that was consumed in New York every day.
Wow.
Well, he picked up milk cans then, and he said, "I was making pretty good money till Myron Christfield bought a new Ford Model T and took several of my customers by offering to haul cheaper. So this didn't set very well with me. So I took the exhaust of my car, cut in a Y, I put an exhaust whistle on the Y consisting of 5 pipes, the longest being 6 inches. Said I would pull up behind Marvin when he was going slowly, come up behind him and pull the whistle open, and his truck pulled over so fast I thought it was shot sideways." So you can imagine all of a sudden thinking a locomotive's on your rear bumper. So that was, you know, a little bit. He's got a lot of humor in this, and that's why I hope people will take time to read it.
And the beginning of his mechanical enterprise.
Yes. Well, some family members then had ventured to Alaska and taken up mining around Flat. Elmer came along when his Uncle Oscar invited him to do so. He says that Ina and Uncle Gus had gone to Flat City from Butte, Montana, much earlier in 1913. His brother Oscar's and his wife and daughter also went from Butte, and a few years later, they tried a few other things but decided that, yeah, we want to go back and try mining. So Oscar began making trips to Flat City, where he worked as a shoreman on a gold dredge. His wife and daughter stayed in Detroit. Here's one of those things that we always find amazing. It says, Oscar went each spring to Nenana by train from Seward. He got off the train and with a pack sack on his back, walked the 400 miles to Flat, following the winter mail dog team trail. In the fall, when the dredge closed down,
he came back.
Reverse trip.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. If you have a question for Nick Nugent on this story, we're at 907-458-TALK, 907-458-8255. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fish on! The Valdez Fishing Report is brought to you proudly by Frontier Outfitters. Drop in for a visit to their extensive fishing department. From rods to reels, lures to lines, you'll see fresh and saltwater as well as fly fishing tackle for every game fish in Alaska. Stock up on supplies for your Alaskan-sized summer of fun. Coolers to camping gear, Frontier Outfitters is your first stop to making your next outdoor adventure a success. Your store for the outdoors, Frontier Outfitters, for your Alaskan lifestyle.
It's time for the Valdez Fishing Report. Interviews, derby standings, tips, and advice for Prince William Sound.
Alaska Department of Fish and Game reports halibut fishing has been fair to good with most anglers, picking up bigger fish further out near the entrances of Prince William Sound, including Montague Strait and Hinchinbrook Entrance. Alaska Department of Fish and Game suggests fishing around Perry Island for those wanting to stay closer, and reports of catching Pacific gray cod have been good throughout Prince William Sound. Lingcod season opened July 1st, and several trophy lingcod weighing in at over 55 pounds were caught this week. Fish cutter Pat Olson said he's starting to see more pink salmon coming in, and has even filleted a few silver salmon. The 2023 Valdez Kids Pink Salmon Derby is Saturday, July 22nd, and is open to kids age 5 to 16. Kids qualify for prizes by picking up a free Valdez Fish Derby's hat and posting a picture of themselves with the hat and pink salmon in Valdez. Winners will be chosen at random to win cash prizes and fishing poles. The Kids Derby is sponsored by Valdez Fish Derbies, and there is no entry fee. Pink salmon fishing is generally productive at Allison Point and along other shorelines. Pixie, spinners, and Vibrex are all good options. The Valdez Silver Salmon Derby will start July 22nd with a grand prize of $10,000 cash for the largest fish caught. The Women's Silver Salmon Derby is slated for Saturday, August 12th. A pirate treasure hunt is slated for Friday, August 11th. For more information on the Valdez Fish Derbies, visit www.valdezfishderbies.com.
The fishing is great in Valdez, Alaska. It's also a beautiful place to get out and explore the waters of Prince William Sound. Cast from shore or spend the day on a charter. Have your catch processed and shipped fresh right from the harbor. Stop by the Visitor Center on Fairbanks Drive for more information on accommodations, tours, events, culture, and everything Valdez has to offer. Discover more at valdezalaska.org.
KVAK's Valdez Fishing Report. Fish Valdez and reel in a big one.
KFAR weather.
Chance for isolated showers today. Otherwise, overcast skies. High temperatures reach up to 68. Winds out of the west, 8 to 15 miles per hour. Partly cloudy skies tonight. Lows level off around 54. Lots of sunshine tomorrow. Highs level off around 74. And that's your weather on KFAR 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Jennifer Wojcicki.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at kfarradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back in the studio here with Nick Nugent talking about a unique person at a unique time in Alaska, in a unique area of Alaska. And right now they're going into the Iditarod Flat area.
They are. So Elmer accompanied his uncle. They made it to Seward after, you know, the typical train trip out, spent a couple of days in Seattle looking around till their ship sailed. They came up on the Alaska. By this time, ships were much better than what we've talked about back during the original gold rush. So they had a berth for two people for $65 each, which doesn't seem to me to be a particularly expensive passage. So they boarded the ship, made it to Seward. Fare was $87 each, which included meals and a stateroom with two berths. Well, the trip to Seward then took 7 days, mostly because they were stopped everywhere. It was a milk run.
Yeah.
Taking cannery items off on
mail.
Mail, all
food.
Of that.
Food.
Everything that was needed, the ships did.
Yeah.
So the train was waiting at Seward, so they went and got straight on the train. They had run into Frank Dorbin, the pilot, and he was trying to talk them into letting him fly them up. $350 per person, and Uncle Oscar basically told him, he said, well, it's only going to cost $65 each over the trail, and we can walk for free. So they got off at Nenana, stayed overnight at the small two-story Cooney Hotel. Well, then they're off to Iditarod on foot to save the $350 each. Once there, Elmer had a job on the dredge lined up, so they spent a little bit of time settling in. 17 days it took them to get there. When he talks about the trip, it was weather to 30 below, walked a long way, and he mentions that they had their parkas, pack sacks on, headed west. The trail was pretty well packed, at least, you know, till some snows came along. They went from one maintained roadhouse to another. Where there were not commercial roadhouses, the government had shelter houses. And what they would do is they would buy food at a commercial roadhouse and then eat, stay there, and then take a day's meal with them to for their next stop. So when they got to one of the shelter roadhouses, the government road commission maintained, they'd always chop wood, leave everything ready in case the next person that got there was in emergency situation. So kind of the old rules of the trail still applied. Well, a few relief cabins then didn't have a caretaker, and that's when they'd buy food. Said the first day out of Nenana, they met Bill Burke, the mail musher, coming with his mail team of 26 dogs, and Elmer mentions that he thought the dogs were going to tear them apart. They couldn't get far enough off the road. And apparently, you know, the dogs all snapping and snarling, and so Elmer was said he pretty well shy of dogs for a bit. Well, they kept going, and they had a pretty rough day on their fifth day on Lake Manitoumina. There was a howling wind, snowstorm facing us, walking into it for a distance of 26 miles.
I know it. Just ponder that.
Yeah, we don't like to walk from here over to to Cushman Street.
Or to your mailbox.
That's too far. I don't need to know what's in there.
You know, 26 miles in gusts of 15 miles an hour wind at minus 30 below.
Yeah. And it was just another day on the trail.
Yeah.
He does mention, though, the first day that they were after their first day's trip, you know, and walking on snow and different conditions, is that their legs were so sore that they staggered about like sailors in a hurricane. Well, so one night it snowed about a foot and was still snowing. They didn't have snowshoes, but they got lucky. And Charlie O'Halloran, who was the other part of the mail team, Bill took half the route, Charlie took the second half, fortunately was just ahead of him and packing down trail pretty well. So that worked out. Well, the customs then at all the roadhouses, he talks about the food, and he says he learned to enjoy the stewed prunes. Put a little bit of sugar on them.
I saw that, yeah. You know, everyone did. That was a staple.
Yeah, no, it certainly was.
And it was always out on the table.
Yeah, and everybody, there was just, I guess, promote regularity.
That's a clear vision.
Well, it said they could help themselves to the prunes anytime they wanted. And I thought that was interesting, too, because I'd always figured the roadhouses had to be kind of tight just for the problems of getting supplies in. But
all you can eat, the breakfast that they serve and the dinners that they served. You're heading out on the trail and you packed your second breakfast for your lunch.
Now, room and board was up to $4 per person by this time when I think we've talked about the early Valdez Trail, when that would have been $1 to $1.50, according to where you were. But nonetheless, it was all a system that certainly, if you were willing to put in the effort to walk, it was doable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they finally went on, and he talks a little bit about McGrath and the big NC store there and one at Tocotna. They left Tocotna and stopped at Victor and Amelia Hill's house, about 6 miles from there. They were really good friends of Oscar's, and they made a living by ground sluicing. Had a sluice box on the ground, and they only used water pressure they had and picked shovel wheelbarrows to dump the rock into the sluices, which were usually fairly long, and then they'd go through and do a cleanup every so often. So it was not a very expensive way of mining as far as capitalization went, but it was obviously slow by the amount of dirt you could move. Elmer became snowblind during this. He'd forgotten to wear his sunglasses. And when they stopped at one of the roadhouses, they said they went to see a man named Eric Hard when they got to Ophir. He was an elderly man, one of those jack-of-all-trades people. He said he learned a lot through experience and reading, and he was the village dentist. That is, he pulled people's teeth with an ordinary pair of pliers and no anesthetic. He was also the blacksmith and barber. He said, he put a drop of silver nitrate in each of my eyes. I went to bed the next morning. My troubles were over. So again, when you're out mining, even into the late 20s here, if you had a toothache, you couldn't just hop over and go see your dentist. You had to find somebody that was brave enough to pull the tooth for
and
you.
And he knew the cure of snow blindness, too.
Yes, yeah. Yeah, had, like you said, he was a jack of all trades. He'd learned a lot of things.
And your eyes didn't drain. It drained through your nasal passages.
Uh-huh.
Who would have thought of that?
Well, after 17 days, they came to Iditarod, which, of course, had been founded back in 1912 when gold was discovered on Flat Creek, 8 miles away. The town was formed because it was as far up the Iditarod River as barges and steamships could go. There was a tram built between the two, which was built on dimensional lumber for rails and had a little gasoline motor of some kind to pull along the cars and the supplies. The government then eventually built a gravel road from Iditarod to Flat, and the tramway was pretty well abandoned, and at that point Iditarod became just a riverboat landing. They had a big warm storage building there, and he talks about something else that would be a little odd to us. He said they brought perishables and unloaded them there. So this big warehouse was insulated and heated in the winter to keep things from freezing. He said many cases of eggs were stored through the long winters and became pretty strong. In 1929, when fresh eggs were brought in by airplane, one of the old-timers told me, "I don't like those airplane eggs. There's no taste to them."
Not as rich.
Certainly.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, Oscar and he went to the store. They met another person, John Orr Ogris, who worked with them for years. And he sold Elmer a little 12-by-14 log cabin for $150. Elmer moved in. It was pretty sparsely settled, but furnished. But he had a good eiderdown sleeping bag, a pillow and sheets, and got a few cords of wood from his Uncle Gus, who ran a freighting system. And then he ate at Henry Duran's restaurant, charged $1 a meal.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break and leave you with some bumper music, Fox News, state news, commercials, weather. And we'll be back.
Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
President Biden says Ukraine will eventually be part of NATO, but not today.
It's going to happen. We're moving, you're all moving in the right direction.
The president speaking at the NATO summit in Lithuania. Ukraine's leader, Volodymyr Zelensky, had been pushing to join the military alliance as he continues to battle that Russian invasion of his country. FBI Director Christopher Wray is playing defense and telling the House Judiciary Committee agents are not working to remove conservative opinions from social media.
The FBI is not in the business of moderating content or causing any social media company to suppress or censor.
Today's hearing comes after a federal judge halted White House officials from communicating with leaders of big tech companies over worries about government censorship on social media. America is listening to Fox News.
It's time for your Alaska News Minute.
As salmon surge into South Central fisheries, anglers and dip netters are reminded to properly dispose of fish waste. Discarding fish waste on public, private property or along roads, pull-offs, and trails can attract bears into areas frequented by the public and result in fines ranging from $300 to $1,000. In Anchorage, where nearly 300,000 people live in close proximity to bears, fish waste is discarded each summer in vacant lots, green belts, and along local streams and lake shores. Anchorage area wildlife biologist Corey Stantor stresses the importance of proper disposal of fish waste, especially in Anchorage near the rivers and highly used trail systems. Fish waste is a huge attractant to bears and can pose an extreme public safety issue to those who are utilizing the trails in Anchorage. Proper disposal of your fish waste is key to protecting yourself and local bears. Dumping fish in these places can also attract big fines. Illegal dumping can lead to penalties of up to $1,000. Anglers who clean fish on site are encouraged to chop carcasses into numerous pieces and throw them into fast-moving water.
Online at KFAR660.com.
With stores in Anchorage, Wasilla, North Pole, Fairbanks, and throughout North America, Glass Doctor is your locally owned and operated solution when you need a windshield. With our G12 Road Hazard Guarantee, you get 1 year peace of mind, knowing we will fix or replace your windshield if it gets damaged or broken for free in Alaska, where they put rocks on the road like on purpose. It's practically a buy one, get one free kind of a deal, and only at Glass Doctor.
Call the Glass Doctor, we'll fix your pains.
Oh, yeah. Are you looking for a rewarding career with stability and upward mobility? The Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development can connect you to job training and apprenticeship programs that open doors to careers offering good wages and benefits. Whether it's classroom or online, weekend or night classes, find the right training program for you. Build your skills, build your career, build Alaska's future. Visit alaskajobs.alaska.gov or visit your local Alaska Job Center to learn more.
We're talking men's health with Dr. Tony Nima from Fairbanks Urology.
Some guys are unlucky that they end up in a situation where their bladder won't empty without a catheter. That's because the prostate is blocking the bladder. There are warning signs that this might end up happening, like slow stream, frequency, urgency, and getting up in the middle of the night to use the bathroom. And we do have non-invasive procedures to help avoid that situation.
Fairbanks Urology, now in their beautiful new location, along with Fairbanks Clinic at the corner of Cushman and Gaffney.
You need to celebrate the little things in life as much as possible. Getting off work early? Grab a Charbroil Brewster Burger. Taking the clothes out of the dryer? Try their chicken ciabatta sandwich. A good hair day? You deserve the deep-fried Alaskan halibut. It doesn't matter what you're celebrating, your birthday, dinner with out-of-town guests, or drinks with brewtizers with friends, you need to stop by Brewster's.
Great food, great Alaskan spirits, that's Brewster's.
By the way, if you do fold the clothes after you get them out of the dryer, you deserve one of Brewster's shakes with Oreo crumbles.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. Nick Nugent taking us through mining activity in the flat Iditarod area.
Yeah, it was an interesting time, this pre-war. A lot more people there, certainly, than there were at any time after.
Mm-hmm.
Elmer talks a little bit about daily life in the area. I mentioned he just said that he'd paid $1 a meal. Well, he got paid once a month and in gold coin.
Yeah.
Fives, tens, twenties, whatever. And he mentions that when he'd walk around town to pay his bills for different things and head to the bank, he said, I always had a pretty heavy pocket.
And he sent money home.
He did. Yeah, because times were so hard there. Yeah. He was living fine, and it was not an uncommon thing in that day. You read a lot of the early miners sent money back to family to try to keep going.
Yeah, keep them going.
Well, around the middle of May then, he had worked a little bit for his Uncle Gus, who had woodcutters, paid him $14 a cord for wood, which he then brought into town. A lot of wood used, obviously, all the heating, and the dredges out there were wood-fired. They weren't electric, so they had steam boilers, and that ate a lot of wood. About the middle of May, he says they finished overhauling the dredge, and this one had a huge diesel engine in it, the particular dredge he was on, and it ran 24 hours a day with a stop each day for 10 minutes to allow the oilers to pump the heavy grease into all the fittings and cups. And he said every morning he started out melting heavy black grease on the forge and poured some on all the open gear teeth. So basically the oiler's job wasn't too bad. He has some hilarious stories when he's talking about what went on the dredge. And they had several practical jokers. And the dredge master didn't like the foreman sitting watching him. The dredge master, that was his job. He knew what he was doing, and he didn't need watch. So he and another guy drove a bunch of very small nails through the bench where the foreman used to sit till they barely came through, and then hooked them to a rather large storage battery in the other room. That morning when the foreman came in, they jolted him one. And he jumps up and says, that was electricity. He couldn't find the nail heads at first. Eventually he did. And it all worked out okay because you didn't want to fire a good dredge master in the middle of the season.
No.
Well, he made $10 a day for a 10-hour shift, so $1 an hour. At the end of each month, he got a check for $310. And he talks about sending money home. He stayed on a little bit in the fall after the dredge started to shut down to help his Uncle Gus. They moved every building in town because they realized some of the best pay dirt was under town.
Yeah.
They wanted to bring the dredge back through.
Old flat and new flat.
They jacked them up and moved them out of the way. He talks a little bit, too, about costs. He said they'd go down and see what happened. The big thing was an airplane landing. Go down and see who came in town, who was there, and what news did they have from outside. Said air freight was very expensive. His Aunt Ina once ordered 6 bananas from Fairbanks, and it cost her $3. So, you know, that would have been a shock in 1929.
Yeah.
Well, said that at his in flat, a quarter was the smallest coin used in the villages, although in Anchorage, they would break down and use nickels and dimes. Well, Elmer went outside to visit family after the 29 season to Trumansburg, New York, with a contractor on a road job for some trucks he owned. He had been dating Hildur Kertu. Her folks were from Finland also and lived in Minnesota and then moved to this part of New York. She had one sister, and who married a friend of Elmer's, and Elmer married Hildur. It said they went to all the Finnish midsummer dances. That's how they met. And he said he often laughed at how Sulo, his friend, boosted the girls back through their bedroom window in the mornings, 5 feet off the ground while their parents were in the kitchen having coffee, preparing to go milk the cows. Said those dances often lasted all night, and we weren't ones to leave early. So they were married in Buffalo on April 16th, 1933. His Uncle Oscar passed away. He had miner's consumption, or emphysema, caused by breathing in the copper ore dust when he'd worked in Butte. That was unfortunately not an uncommon fate for hard rock and underground miners. They almost always died of some lung disease. Well, he went to work on, came back to Alaska, and his Aunt Bertha, Uncle Oscar's wife, decided to sell her home and go with him. She came here to Fairbanks and worked for Cap Lathrop in his apartments all the way to her death from a heart attack in 1943.
So I saw that, yeah.
Yeah, she was a Fairbanks fixture. Went to work 1st of April. They were overhauling the dredge for another season of digging. Elmer talks about when, as oiler, and having, you know, not something he had to concentrate on every minute, that he would hear things come onto the dredge and land in the trommels, clattering and clanking. He'd go down, and often they were shovels, axes, picks, different tools that had been lost, the dredge picked up. He would take them out, clean everything up on an emery wheel, and put new handles on, so they were always stocked for tools. Again, I think that just shows you in those days.
No waste.
No waste. It shows what something was worth.
Yeah.
They would have not understood the term recycling. It was just an absolute way of life.
Reuse, not recycle.
Well, they'd charge at the store all through the winter, pay up in summer during the work season, and again, prices were kind of high due to transportation from Seattle. Their cabins started getting eroded away. So after working 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, Elmer jacked the cabin up, dug a trench around it, and moved it out of the way of the creek. So again, this is not a man that let a lot of moss grow on him.
No.
Well, in 1935, heading up, said they had a dance at the Moose Hall once a month. They were staying through the winters by this time. With nothing else to do, he said, we visited back and forth with families that spent the winter in Flat. Many that could afford it went to the States to escape the cold weather, so a lot of snowbirds. But on Christmas Eve, they would have a huge party at the Moose Hall. All the school children had a program and presents, a large potluck, and danced the rest of the night. So the women were few in number, so they pretty well had to dance every dance. He and Hilder decided to walk home, which was a pretty good ways. And poor Hilder almost didn't make it because she was so tired from the dance and the trail conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I coaxed her on by telling her the camp was around the next corner. I sure had to say that a lot after we rounded each bend. He said, finally made it to the cabin at dusk. So they had left the day before, danced all night, and walked to the cabin all through the day. So you can imagine how worn out you'd be. Elmer started mining then on Moore Creek. His own mine.
Yep.
Went to work for himself. He mined there several years, and he did reasonably well. He bought it from a fella called Wino Koskinen, who was known, most people that couldn't pronounce his name. He was pretty well locally known as Billy the Finn. And he'd been mining for a lot of years at Moore Creek, 40 miles east of Flat. And he was $12,000 in debt to the grocery by this time and the bank, both owned by Harry Donnelly. So he had $6,000 left in the fall of 35 after he paid his crew. But unfortunately, instead of paying Donnelly, he went to visit the girls on down on the line and kept him drunk and got the whole $6,000. He complained that he was broke, and Harry foreclosed on him. So Gus, his brother Charlie, and Gus's partner John Ogris decided to buy the mine, and Elmer went in with them, and they would all mine there. They'd worked a lot of they worked the whole summer. They had to drag everything the 40 miles over, and if you read the story, there's some pretty remarkable stories that are a little bit similar as each happened, but some of the places and getting stuck with huge pieces of equipment and then getting it out basically with muscle power.
Horsepower.
Yes.
Fairbanks, we're going to take a commercial break. You're listening to KFAR Radio. We'll be back after these messages.
More Problem Corner is coming up on KFAR 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Let's face it, life can certainly bring accidents our way. Whether it's a vehicle accident or a bad fall on the ice, your injuries can range from mild and temporary to a life of chronic pain and disability. If you find yourself in that situation, call Jason Wiener and Associates. This outstanding group offers five attorneys with decades of experience. Get the facts and opinions that you need and solid advice so you can make informed decisions. They will design a retainer agreement that works for you and your case. Make sure you are represented by the right attorney, Jason Wiener and Associates. 907-452-5196.
Attention all seniors over 50. The Alaska International Senior Games begin August 5th right here in Fairbanks. Bowling, power walking, pickleball, archery, ice hockey, tennis, track and field, and more. Over 16 events with a $20 discount if you register by July 15th. The return of the Alaska International Senior Games. For more information, go to alaskaisg.org. And don't forget to find them on Facebook. Get ready for the Alaska International Senior Games August 5th through the 13th.
The Fairbanks Clinic has been here for you since 1932, the year Amelia Earhart completed the first female nonstop solo flight across the Atlantic, the year BBC aired their first television broadcast. That was over 90 years ago, and they're still here, still taking care of you and your family. That's the Fairbanks Clinic in their beautiful building at the corner of Cushman and Gaffney. Call and schedule your appointment today with their family care practice. That's the Fairbanks Clinic, here for you since 1932.
Fairbanks, are you ready? It's the Jeans Chrysler Ram Golden Days Rodeo and Music Fest July 15th and 16th at the Tanana Valley State Fairgrounds. It's the biggest summer event you won't want to miss. Saturday, gates open at 3 with Ram Championship Rodeo at 5. Sunday, gates open at noon with Rodeo Action at 2. Saturday, after the rodeo, Ampersand presents Nashville's recording artist Britt Stokes Band performing live. Get your tickets now and save $2 off at your Fairbanks Fred Meyer or RodeoAlaska.com.
Weather brought to you by GCR. Maintaining your correct tire pressure improves safety, fuel economy, and tire life. Drop by the Tire Guys for free tire inflation. GCR Tires and Service, taming the Alaskan road. Van Horn at Cushman.
KFAR weather.
Chance of isolated showers today, otherwise cloudy. High of 68, west winds 8 to 15 miles per hour. Lows level off around 54. Tonight, partly cloudy skies. Highs around 74. Tomorrow, mainly sunny. Chance for scattered rain showers Friday and Saturday. Low 70s, Friday, mid 70s by Saturday. And that's your weather on KFAR, 660 AM and 97.5 FM. I'm meteorologist Laura Lockwood.
And now, more Problem Corner on KFAR Radio, 97.5 FM, 660 AM, and streaming live at KFARradio.com.
Fairbanks, welcome back. Here with Nick Nugent. Enjoying a miner's tale, trail and tailings.
Well, Elmer over on Moore Creek said he worked hard all summer. We had two 10-hour shifts 7 days a week. But when freeze-up came, we found that our total expenses were a lot more than we got from the gold. Things looked pretty discouraging. And Otto Mikkola came, and he and I trapped Martin on the side. We got quite a few of the skins. Ray, their son, was born on December 1st, and actually, Elmer didn't get the good news.
Ray's electric.
Yeah, Ray's electric. Elmer did not get the good news till 27 days later it took for the message to travel. So he was very happy, of course, to hear that he had a son, and their both son and mother were well. Well, come spring, Elmer and his nephew started hauling supplies from Flat to Moose Creek, and they anticipated using a drag line, which they had bought from Gus and Gus's partner. Elmer describes the hauling at this point. He said the first day we went out hauling, we ran into huge snowdrifts over the summit to Bonanza Creek. Bulldozing it aside was too slow. Better time was made by going with the dozer blade, taking off only a couple of feet, backing up, and going again, making about 15 miles to the day. So imagine how much that would beat you up. Smashing into a snowdrift, backing up, and hitting it again all day long. And certainly, they did what they had with the equipment they had. Said they were they got stuck on the second day, and they had to dig a space down to the moss, built a fire with damp wood, using fuel oil to keep it burning. Said they lay down, but the heat from their bodies made the quilt wet where it drew frost up from the ground. It was 30 below zero. He said sleep was impossible. they didn't expect to have to sleep out. They knew that the next time they'd remember to bring a waterproof canvas with them. Well, they had a lot of really bad weather that spring, a lot of blowing. So a lot of problem with drifting. They only managed 3 miles one day because the drifting was so bad. They finally, though, got everything there, and they knew that Hilder had arrived with Ray, and she was safe in Iditarod and would come and join them as soon as the weather was agreeable for a small plane. The dragline operator and helper had left Slate Creek up there, and that was where Gus and John's mine was. He kept coming at a steady pace and decided to try to break trail with a drag line, and it turns out with it being so big and heavy and powerful, it just kept wallowing right through everything, mashing trees out of the way, and they found out that in that particular area, the drag line was the best thing to break trail with, except it occasionally would get stuck, and then they had quite a fight on their hands. They used an old Cat 60 bulldozer, which was getting pretty good age by this time, and this is basically, they would use that, and they kept pushing away the tailings as they came up the lower end of the boxes when they were mining. They decided they were doing well enough this year, had got into better ground, that they bought a brand new D8 bulldozer, which they had shipped up from Seattle. The way they had to do that, he was a radio operator, and he had taught himself Morse code, and he actually tapped out the order to a radio station in Anchorage that's then sent a telegram on to the business, the cat business in Seattle.
And is all accepted.
Yes.
I'm buying another, you know, here's my Morse code to Anchorage to radio in Seattle.
And that's a contract.
Yeah. And the reduction of it was made.
It was. Well, Elmer did a little bit of everything in the off season. He also took a job as a welder and mechanic and worked with cleanups. He hooked up the pipelines and moved ahead with the drag line. So he had his own mine he was working, plus picking up things as he could, just needed the cash economy. He said the cleanups were good all summer with lots of nuggets. We were still a little in debt when freeze-up came, that being September 1937, and everyone except Hilder, Ray, and Elmer left to spend the winter in the States. Said they had a wonderful winter. The weather was good. They shot a big bull moose for meat, trapped marten, played pinochle, did a lot of skiing and snowshoeing, and enjoyed each other's company. So I think another thing we can see here, this is a fellow that the simple parts of life were good enough for him.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh, yeah,
he was just quite happy with home life and having food. And
That's how he grew up.
Yeah, had even food in the freezer, you were good.
He wasn't farming.
No, exactly. So they ended up the next year being able to start working around the middle of June, and they had had a very profitable season that year. That would have been 38. They stayed on at the end of the season to repair equipment, get everything going. So now we're up to about 1941, and Elmer's been outside during the winter, learning to fly. In the fall, he says, in the fall of 1940, I began taking lessons from a friend, Bill Litio, an instructor at the Ithaca, New York airport. He'd gone out for the winter this time. After 8 hours of dual time, he let me solo. Then I built up some time, and in the fall of 41, I went to Lock Haven, Pennsylvania to finish my private license and buy a Piper Supercruiser. Said on December 7th, Hilder, Hulda, and Solo came down to see me. I was doing takeoffs and landings when the instructor came running out and waved me to the hangar, told me Pearl Harbor had been bombed by the Japanese, and that all civilian training was canceled from that point on. So something he was learning to do and enjoyed doing, unfortunately, was cut short by the war. So that fall, the government put the closure on mining because it was not an essential industry. And he found a right before the closure went in, it had done some drilling and found a really good spot. So they actually ended up cashing out of 41 pretty well. And so we all came to Fairbanks wondering what to do next. Hilder and he started looking around for a place to buy, got a little log cabin in the center of town, so probably somewhere right around where we are.
Mm-hmm.
He decided to bring all the D8s to Fairbanks and had help from Victor Neck. Victor's an interesting guy. He started out in Healy, and he was a fixture at Wiseman for a long time. Left a wonderful photo collection of mining in the Wiseman area.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they picked up all the D8s, and they went to Flat and fixed up Gus and John's, brought it in. The light viscosity oil wasn't known in those days, so each day when they finally stopped, they'd drain the oil, put it in a heater, put it back in the cats hot. It took 29 days to go from Flat to Nenana, about 350 miles. The temperature hovered about 50 below zero every day. It was the longest extreme cold spell of all my years in Alaska, Elmer tells us.
30 days at 50 below, moving heavy equipment.
Yeah, sitting on something steel that's only going to be warm on the engine.
Think they had some caribou hides?
I would suppose so. Well, at Nenana, turns out the Federal Aeronautics Authority gave him a contract to haul 400 tons of airport building supplies, lumber, fuel, gasoline, and so forth, 40 miles back to Lake Minchumina. So they were very grateful to have run into that. Okay. There's an event that took place. They were moving material out to Galena, and they went through the ice on the Yukon, and if you go ahead and Google that, like I mentioned, and go to the Katuri site, you'll find this great video of a hard hat diver going through the ice, rigging up the cat that went through, and after just 5 hours, they had the cat fully back in operating condition.
How'd they pull it out?
With other caterpillars that were on site. They had had a cat train going. So,
okay.
That's kind of the end of the story ends. He did do some mining after the war, but the prices had gotten extremely high for fuel, labor. The government was hiring a lot of people for all the military buildup, and it just wasn't a profitable thing. So this was written in 1984, and if I remember right, Elmer lived to 1996. He was outside.
Wow.
But it lived a good long life, considering as hard of conditions as he'd been in.
Mm-hmm.
It's a good story of, I think, what happened to a lot of people who never wrote about themselves and will never know. And I think Elmer's got, in some ways, a more common miner story than a lot of the ones we read about with a lot of flash and bang.
Hmm. You know, every story, I learned something. You know, the interaction between getting to Iditarod, then getting the Flat. You always hear about the Iditarod sled dog race. You never hear about Flat Alaska.
No.
The Flat Mining District, not the Iditarod Mining District, the Flat Mining District. And this gateway town to the mining areas.
And it was interesting, you know, like you said, today, Iditarod's the famous name.
Yeah.
Back then, it had almost died away.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't needed. It wasn't where the gold was, sort of like Chena and Fairbanks.
So what are you thinking about the next time we meet in August?
Well, right now, I've been kind of looking at some of the military air photo surveys that were done, mostly by the Navy, some by the Army, and a lot of the early mapping that was done in Southeast all the way to Kodiak.
That'd be fun.
Yeah. Pretty interesting stuff when you read about this was the early days of that kind of work.
Nick, thank you very much for coming in and sharing the story. As always, it's wonderful. And Fairbanks, you have a great day. I will see you on Friday while I have Assembly candidate Aaron Gibson in the studio with me. I will see you on Friday.